This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the medical, legal, and ethical debate about how we die, one of the most important cases is that of Karen Ann Quinlan. My guests are her parents, Julia and Joseph Quinlan. In 1975, 21-year-old Karen fell into a coma that was believed to be the result of drinking gin and tonics on top of tranquilizers. When doctors told the Quinlan family that Karen was in a permanent vegetative state and would never emerge from the coma, the family asked the doctors to remove Karen from the respirator, which everyone assumed was keeping her alive. The doctors refused, and the Quinlan family was blocked every step of the way until the New Jersey State Supreme Court ruled in their favor. The 20th anniversary of that decision will be commemorated later this week with a conference in Princeton. The Quinlan family's legal victory was hardly the end of the story. After being taken off the respirator, Karen remained in a coma for 9 years. On this 20th anniversary of the landmark legal decision, we asked Julia and Joseph Quinlan to reflect on their experience. I asked them when it first became clear to them that Karen wasn't going to come out of the coma.
Well, I was the first one to recognize it several weeks after she went into the coma, when I noticed that her legs and feet were flexing inward and that she was starting to form into a fetal position. And that made me realize that it was deeper than a coma, that she had extensive brain damage. My husband and my other two children were not ready to accept this yet. Gradually, John and Mary Ellen did accept it, and I did, when we talked, I suggested that they not mention it to their father because he was not ready, he had not reached that point, and it's very, very important to allow each individual to reach it in their own time.
Joseph Quinlan, do you agree that you were the last in the family to reach that point of feeling she wasn't coming out of it?
Yes, I... I have a very strong faith, and I was still holding out for a miracle, praying a night and day for a miracle. And finally, I began to realize that there wasn't going to be any miracle, that this was just something that I would have to go through. And it was very difficult for me. And the only way I could possibly accept what was happening was, in my own mind, to place her in the loving, gentle hands of the Lord and ask Him to use her as any way He wanted to reach anybody, any place in the world with his message. And when he was through, the only thing I asked is that he raise her up with him. And then that way I was able to accept it, that, yes, we were going to lose Karen.
Mrs. Quinlan, was it you who first suggested it to the family that maybe you should think about taking her off the respirator?
Yes, it was. I suggested it to John and to Mary Ellen. As I said, we waited.
Your children?
That's our other two children. And we just had to wait until Joe was able to recognize it. Although the doctors kept telling us that there was absolutely no help, no hope, and that they had also suggested that she be removed from the respirator.
Did you both think what would Karen have wanted?
Oh, we knew what Karen would have wanted, and that's why it was a horrendous decision to make, but it's always very helpful if you know what your loved one's wishes are. And Karen had shared particularly with me on a number of occasions that she had seen a friend's father or mother die, and that she had seen them on using extensive measures to keep them alive, and she had said she would never want to be kept alive that way, that she would just rather die naturally. So it was a difficult decision, but at least we were able to make the decision because we knew that would be her wishes.
Mr. Quinlan, you mentioned your deep faith. Did you consult a priest and ask for his advice about
yes,
what to
I
do?
Oh, yes, I certainly did. As soon as the prognosis was complete, as a matter of fact, before the prognosis was complete, I was talking to my spiritual director and very good friend and pastor, Father Tonja Passo. And he had stated to me at one time, when I was trying to get her off the respirator in order to get her into another facility where she could receive therapy for her limbs and stuff like that, did I have the moral right to risk her life in order to possibly get her well? And he said, you certainly have. And he told me a long time after that at that time he had mentioned to me that, as a matter of fact, according to our church's teachings on moral law, you can ask her to have her removed permanently from the machine since she is terminally ill, and so forth. And he said, you didn't hear me at that time because you blocked it out. You weren't ready for that yet. You were just asking for this other thing to have her. You were still looking for a miracle, in other words.
What did your doctor say?
The two physicians in charge, when it was hopeless, the prognosis was complete, they came to us and they had a meeting with Julie and I, and they said that, tell us what it is that you want, but whatever you decide, talk it over with the family and be sure you are all 100% in agreement on your decision. And he said, if you can do that, then come back and we'll have a meeting and even meeting with someone in a hospital staff and decide what we're going to do then.
How did the decision to take her off the respirator end up in court?
Because the people involved, the hospital and the physicians, reneged on their agreement. We signed the form at the hospital that same night when we went back and told the physicians of our decision to remove her from the respirator. And they sent down to the hospital office for the necessary paper. We signed the paper, and the hospital chaplain was there and so forth. And only a day or so later, they had consulted their mentors and people that they looked up to, and also the hospital. And the hospital consulted their attorney, and they were all told, definitely not, stay away from it. It was considered manslaughter at the time.
Homicide.
Homicide. And not only that, I guess their fear was also that if and when Karen did die, then we could possibly sue maybe years later down the road. And that was always a big threat, and it's a threat with all physicians today.
So were you sure right away that you would take this to court, or was that a difficult decision to make?
Oh, no. We knew we had to follow our desires, because we wanted to do what was right for Karen and to do what we thought she would want us to do. So we had no alternative but to seek out an attorney and to go to court. But we thought it would be a very simple procedure that the attorney would only request that Joe be made guardian of his daughter. But, of course, the result of it is history.
We never expected everyone to appear in court and fight against us. You know, the each physician had their own attorney. The attorney general of the state was there. The attorneys representing the hospital. Another attorney representing the court-appointed legal guardian, the county prosecutor was there. They were all on one side of the court, and all on the other side was just my wife and I and the children and one attorney.
Julia and Joseph Quinlan are my guests, and they're the parents of the late Karen Quinlan. In March of 1976, the Supreme Court of New Jersey ruled unanimously in your favor, and the decision said no compelling interest of the state could compel Karen to endure the unendurable, only to vegetate a few measurable months with no realistic possibility of returning to any semblance of a cognitive or sapient state. When the court ruled unanimously in your favor, did the doctor say, okay, or did you still have to work hard to get the doctors to agree?
We still had to fight with the hospital and with the doctors to remove her from the respirator. They just refused to do or to abide by the decision. So again, we had to have a confrontation with our attorney and with their attorney and with the hospital representatives and demand that they abide by the decision of the Supreme Court.
After the decision, the physicians tried to remove her from the respirator, but you can see that they had so it was like the whole world was looking over their shoulders. They were deathly afraid. They didn't want Karen to die while she was their patient. And they have a medical protocol for removing someone from a respirator. You don't just, like the popular saying, which we kind of hate, pull a plug. It sounds like an execution. They actually wean her from the respirator they put a little gauge in her trach, take the hose from the respirator off, and they watch it very, very carefully. And if the breathing pressure goes down one little bit, she's put back on a respirator. And they were doing this, and they tried it. If her breathing pressure went down a little bit, they'd take her off the respirator. Then they wouldn't try again for another week. and we felt they were doing it like very half-heartedly. And finally, the only way to get them to move on it was brilliant attorney Paul Armstrong met with us, and he said the only way you're going to have to do it is threaten to replace the doctors. And we did in a formal letter, asking them if they did not seriously try to remove it from the respirator, they should step aside and cooperate with the new physicians that we would hire. And then they seriously tried. It took 10 days to get her off the respirator. But the first day was like a minute. The next day, it might have been 2 or 3 minutes, until finally it took 10 days. On the 10th day, she was off round the clock, 24 hours, and then she was off for good.
Mr. Quinlan, when your daughter was finally taken off the respirator, were you still praying for a miracle, or were you praying for her to be released from this terrible life?
At that point, I don't really recall what I was praying for. There was so much pressure of having her removed from a respirator. It was good to have her in a room, you know, separated from all that equipment. We got her into a nursing home right after that, a place where she belonged, in a county nursing home, and without all the equipment. And it was nice to be peaceful again with her. And I was content. We were all content to just leave her the way she was and leave her in God's hands. I know I had prayed that he would use her as his instrument, and when he was ready in his time, he would take her with him.
Did you think his time would be 9 years? I mean, when did you start to realize this was going to be a really long...
I think everyone thought it was going to be a matter of months or possibly even weeks.
Mm-hmm. What went through your mind when you realized this is just the beginning of the story? The story isn't ending here. She's not being released yet.
We learned to take one day at a time and not to look into the future. No one had any idea how long she would survive. She had many battles with pneumonia at the time, and they just treated her with aspirin. And she recovered from each one until 9 years later. Of course, by that time, her body was very weakened. And we were very, very grateful that we were with her when she died. I had always prayed for that, to be by her side.
My guests are Julia and Joseph Quinlan. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Julia and Joseph Quinlan, the parents of Karen Ann Quinlan. During the 9 years that your daughter remained in a coma in a nursing home, how much time were you able to spend with her? How much time did you feel you needed to spend with her?
Well, we visited her in our own time. I visited her generally after work in the afternoons, and sometimes my husband and I would visit her in the evenings. She was in a private room, and we were able to spend as much time with her as we wanted to. We were able to sit there and to play music for her, or to just talk to her, or to just sit by her bedside without worrying that our 5 minutes would be up, which is usually the problem in ICU,
right,
in the hospital, so that it was more relaxed. Of course, visiting Karen for the 9 years became our way of life, and we had accepted it.
I visited Karen every morning on my way into my business and every evening on the way home. Now, it was altogether different from the hospital. It was a lot easier for me then, in that her medical records were available to me. They had them set up at a little table. I'd sit down at a chair and take a look at her notes and see what kind of a night she had. I'd look at the nicest notes. And then in the evening, I'd see what kind of a day she had. And any questions at all, they would ask me. And it really took beautiful care of Karen, tying her and spotlessly clean. And they told the physician in charge that they would treat her like it was their own daughter. And they did.
During the years you visited her in the nursing home, you'd speak with her, and I think you left music on for her
to
hear.
Definitely.
What was your assumption about what she could still, what could still reach her, and what did the doctors and nurses have to say about that?
Well, the nurses always encouraged us to speak to Karen and to have her friends visit her and to play music, because she just never knew what state that she was in. And not only that, you wanted to treat her as a person.
Mm-hmm.
She still was breathing. She was still alive, and we wanted to. She was still our loving daughter, and to us, she was just as beautiful as ever. And we didn't love her any less because of the condition that she was in. And so we treated her that way. We would go in and I would brush her hair and bring down pretty nightgowns for her and sit and talk to her as I would to anyone else.
You fought very hard to get your daughter taken off the respirator. You went to court for it. Then you fought the doctors when they still resisted you after the New Jersey Supreme Court decided in your favor. Did you at any point think that you should take her off the feeding tube that she was on when she remained in a coma for years after she was taken off the respirator?
You mean ourselves?
Well, to have the nursing home take her off the machine that was feeding her.
No, not really. We went up before an ethics committee before they admitted Karen, and they had the first time, I guess, the ethics committee was used any place in New Jersey, and they all stood around and they just asked us one question: what kind of care do you expect for us to give your daughter? And we answered that we just expected normal care, comfort, palliative care, and they just looked at each other and they said, well, that's it, and it was so simple, the care that we was asking for. We never asked for anything additional, nor did we ever ask him to remove anything.
The questions about the feeding tube did not come into play until later. I think it was with the woman's name was Claire, and it was someplace in New Jersey. That's when they started to question the feeding tube. But that was a feeding tube that was placed in the stomach, because Karen was just fed through the nostrils. It was a gastro-nostril feeding tube. It was not perhaps what you're thinking of, the feeding tube where you go to court to ask to have that removed.
But she was getting fed through a tube through her nose?
Right, exactly. It was just right. The gastro-feeding tube through the nose.
It was still like a machine that was keeping her alive by feeding her. She wasn't eating, obviously.
No, she couldn't eat, of course. It was...
So how did that seem different?
It was a pharmaceutical product, really.
Right.
You know, it wasn't food. People referred to it as food and water, and they make you feel bad because it's the most essential thing that you can do for your child, is to give them food and water. But it wasn't food and water. It was a pharmaceutical product, a substitute for food, you see. But we still permitted it because... We never asked for that, and we didn't want to start asking for something else then.
No, why did you draw the line there? And did the medical establishment draw the line there as well, that it was one thing to take her off the respirator, it would be another thing to take away nutrition?
As I mentioned to you how I resolved this in my own mind by placing her in the loving, gentle hands of the Lord, and I asked him to use her as his instrument to reach others and so forth. And in his time, when he was ready, I asked him to take her with him to his kingdom. Now, to me to go back years later and say, all right, God, I'm going to take over now and remove the feeding tube, knowing she would die, I just couldn't do that. I wanted to keep her in the Lord's hands and let him decide when she was going to go. And it was simply a matter of faith, that's all.
Mrs. Quinlan, did you have the same thoughts on that?
Yes, I did. And also, you have to realize that Karen was very comfortable once she was removed from the respirator. And so there was really no reason to ask for anything further. We had requested the respirator be removed, and we received that, and that was really all that we were interested in. We felt that was the extraordinary means because it was very obvious that it was a mechanical means and that it was breathing for her. And once she was removed from that and placed in a natural state, we were satisfied.
You have to remember that this was quite a while ago now. Nowadays, when somebody's on a respirator, when they leave the hospital, any place in a hospital, a respirator can be in a private room. They can take the respirator home with them. They can. It's altogether different today. But in those days, the only place in a hospital for a respirator was in intensive care. That's because in the beginning they were afraid they had to have a technician there always, 24 hours a day. And the beds in the hospital were like 4 foot high, plus the railing. All this technology all around the bed. You was like 2 feet away from the bed trying to hold a hand. And it was very hard while she was in the hospital in intensive care.
It sounds to me, Mr. Quinlan, from what you were saying before, that when you prayed to God, you didn't pray that your daughter live or that she be released from this netherworld that she was in, that you prayed that God would just do the right thing.
I felt he would use her as his instrument, as he always does use us. And I wanted him to use Karen, have something good come out of this. And then in his time, that's all, I asked him to take her, raise her up with him. And that's what I feel with all my heart he did. When finally Karen did leave this world, we were at her bedside. We received a call from the physician and from the nurse, rather, who was told by the physician to call and suggest we come down as soon as possible. We were down there. Father Tom was had his forehead on her, had his hand on her forehead while he read out of his Bible, and Julie was holding a hand, and I was on the other side of the bed praying silently, standing, looking down at her when she stopped breathing. So beautiful, so peaceful, you know. We couldn't have asked for anything more.
Joseph and Julia Quinlan, they'll be back with us in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Joseph and Julia Quinlan, the parents of Karen Ann Quinlan. 20 years ago, in a landmark decision, the New Jersey State Supreme Court ruled that the Quinlan family had the right to tell doctors to take their comatose daughter off the respirator that everyone assumed was keeping her alive. But after she was removed from the respirator, she remained in a coma for 9 years. Mr. and Mrs. Quinlan, you started a hospice that opened on April 15th, 1980, on the fifth anniversary of your daughter going into a coma. Tell me why you decided to start a hospice.
Well, when Karen was in the ICU unit, it's when I became aware of patients' needs and also of their family's needs. As I had mentioned before, you were permitted to visit your loved one only 5 minutes on the hour or on the half hour. And you just sat in the waiting room, just waiting and waiting for the next half hour. And I just felt that there had to be a better way to, because you wanted those, that's the time when you want to spend with your loved one and to be able to hold your loved one, to be with them or her as often as possible. So we had received monies for the sale of our book and for the magazine articles, and of course we had no intentions of spending the money on ourselves, and we were looking for some memorial that we could put in Karen's name. Just by accident, I happened to read an article about Dr. Cicely Saunders, who formed the hospice in London. And when I was reading this, I realized hospice is the philosophy that we all believe in, that when a patient is terminal, that you just give them palliative, loving care. And my husband and I, then after that, for 3 years, we visited different hospices in this country. We met with Dr. Cicely Saunders in London, and we made the decision that we wanted to establish a hospice in memory to our daughter, Karen.
And you're both on the board of directors of that hospice.
Yes,
now.
We are. I'm the chairperson of the board, and Joe serves on the board of trustees. And it's just a wonderful memory to Karen. It's so rewarding to us to know that our hospice was there to help the family in need at a time when they so desperately need the support of and love from others. We have professionals, we have the doctors and nurses, social worker, patient volunteers, and they have all this support that you need so desperately when you're caring for someone you love.
In many ways, you both helped to start the right to die debate and the living will movement. Do you think of yourselves in that way, as two of the people who helped start this?
Well, we don't really, but people call us the pioneers of it, yes. We have never, ever, and we still don't consider ourselves as celebrities. We were just the parents of Karen, and we wanted to do what we felt was right for our loving daughter.
I wonder what you think about the recent New York State court ruling that said doctors could legally help terminally ill patients commit suicide in certain circumstances by giving them drugs that would hasten their death. Of course, the patient must be mentally competent and request the doctor's help.
It really has nothing, our case has nothing to do with suicide in any way, shape, or form. They're talking about something entirely different, about deliberately terminating someone's life. Really, the decision of the New Jersey Supreme Court was something entirely different. They're talking about now removing life support from somebody who was terminally ill to authorize a physician to make an injection in somebody and terminate their life. That's entirely different. See, that's what we avoided, to do anything that would risk Karen's life.
What are the parts of the Right to Die movement that you feel closest to and most opposed to?
I favor making my own decision. My husband and I, of course, have made out our living will. And I, in New Jersey, of course, it's probably different than it is in this state, in New York. But in the living will, you can explain, you can stress all what you want done, what you do not want done. You can spell everything out. And you also appoint a proxy to make decisions for you if you are incompetent. And what I like about the living will is that you are expressing what you want done. And so that your wishes will be carried out, but it also relieves the loved one of the burden of making the decision for you.
Would you be willing to say what you've written in your living will?
Oh, of course, that no extraordinary means ever be used, that naturally my husband is appointed my guardian, and if we should both die, then our two children are appointed guardian. I would never want my life extended with extraordinary means, and I just want to be comfortable and receive normal care.
Let me ask you, and this might be a tough question, and it might be an out-of-bounds question, I don't know, but if you knew that you were going to be, I'm thinking of your living will here, if you knew that you were going to be in a coma and remain in a coma for 9 years, like your daughter did, would you want to be taken off of the tube that was giving you nutrition and sustenance, or would you want to remain on it? Would that seem like extraordinary means to you? If you had to advise in advance what your family should do in that situation.
If I knew that there was no hope for me to come out of this coma and for me to live, and I think that 9 years is a very long time, that yes, my family would make the decision to have all extraordinary means removed.
Including the feeding tube?
Including the feeding tube, definitely.
When I made out my living will, I made it out in the three parts. I have somebody, my caregiver, to make decisions for me. That would be my wife. But I also spelled out my what I would consider extraordinary means. Now, I give you an example. Say you're terminally ill, on or off a respirator, but you've been determined to be terminally ill, no hope whatsoever of surviving. What would you request that the medical staff eliminate? And they list all the different things, including feeding tubes and so forth. I check them all off, but then there's a spot down below where you can fill your own something else in, you know. And because I have never requested that the feeding tube be removed from my daughter, I didn't want to give the impression that I was against that. So I purposely wrote in, including the feeding tube to be removed, if that was the case with me, Tim and Leo, and so forth.
And why did you include that? I mean, why did you feel that for your daughter, you should leave her on the feeding tube, but for you, if you were in that condition, take you off?
Well, I explained that to you before about my relationship, my prayer with the Lord at the time. I placed her in His care.
But don't you feel that way about yourself?
No. I'd be unconscious. How can I place anyone? How could I place myself in the Lord's care then? I'd be helpless. But it would be my request that I not that feeding tube would not be used if it was a similar situation where there was no hope of survival. And I wanted to make sure that physicians, everyone knew how I felt about it, because I wouldn't want to be that way for 10 years. I don't want to be I wouldn't say any more about that, but I wouldn't want it used.
Okay.
I wouldn't want to be considered a vegetable.
You have to remember that 21 years ago, there was no discussion about a feeding tube. It wasn't until later, after Karen was in this vegetative state for I don't know, maybe 3, 4, 5 years, that suddenly the feeding tube became very prominent in the news and in decision-making. Mm-hmm. At the time that we made the decision, there was no discussions about a feeding tube. So you have to go back to that time. As I said, maybe in 10 years from now, there will be something else that will be considered an extraordinary means that we would never have thought of 21 years ago because we didn't know about it. When Karen sat and talked to me on the many occasions that she would never want to be kept alive in extraordinary ways, she never mentioned the respirator because we had never heard of a respirator at that time. So we only asked to have what we considered extraordinary means removed. Someone else in the same position may have asked for more because they would have considered more as extraordinary means. But in our minds, only the respirator was considered an extraordinary means.
I have another question for you. What are the anniversary dates now that you commemorate of your daughter's life and death?
We commemorate March 29th, which is her birthday, April 15th, the establishment of the hospice program, and June 11th, which is the day that she died.
What do you do on the anniversary date of her death?
We have a mass, a special mass said by Monsignor Trapasso, and then we spend the day together. And on Karen's birthday, we have a mass said at our local parish church. And, of course, on April 15th, we always manage to have a wonderful celebration at the hospice. It's a very joyous day. And last year was the 15th anniversary, and we had a wonderful anniversary celebration.
I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Julia and Joseph Quinlan. Their hospice, the Karen Ann Quinlan Center of Hope Hospice, is located in Newton, New Jersey. This is Fresh Air.